Hello and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very glad you're here with me today. Hosting this podcast means that I am privileged to speak with people who are out in the world making a difference with their day jobs, their programs, their art, and their activism. And I really love doing this. If you would like to support me in doing this work, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by becoming a member of my Patreon community. You can go to patreon.com/OmkariWilliams and sign up. There's also a link on my website, omkariwilliams.com. My guests today do work that speaks powerfully to me because it's all about story. Motivated by their own painful and inequitable experiences in navigating our broken criminal justice system, Complete Picture founders Rebecca Grace and John Gray decided to strive for change. Assembling a team of formerly incarcerated filmmakers, they venture into the homes of individuals facing prison. The crew is united by one soulful purpose: to unmask the true stories of the convicted. Each film, meticulously created, is viewed by the judge deciding the defendant's fate, and they make all the difference. I am so happy to have Rebecca and John with me today to talk about this remarkable project. Hi, Rebecca. Hi, John. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Hi, Omkari. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be talking with you.
Oh, I'm really, really happy to have you both here because for me, what you're doing seems so important, especially because story to me is everything. I mean, I just feel like story underpins everything. So when I came across the work that you're doing, I was immediately captivated. I think story builds bridges between people. I think it reveals our shared humanity. And you're taking that to an entirely new level as you leverage the impact of story to help reduce the sentences of nonviolent offenders who are awaiting a judge's decision on their future. So would you start by talking about what prompted you to start the Complete Picture Project?
In a nutshell, what we're doing at Complete Picture is we're creating videos that humanize individuals who are being sent to prison. The videos are watched by the judge just prior to deciding a person's sentence. And it turns out that they're hugely impactful. We didn't know going into it. It started out as just an experiment, but we were pleasantly surprised to find that they really make a huge difference in achieving sentence reductions and even full negations of people's sentences.
What prompted you to start this in the first place? What was your first impulse?
Well, I've been a filmmaker for over 20 years, and I just felt like, you know, I don't want to be on my deathbed and be thinking, oh, that was a great Coke commercial. You know, I wanted to find a way to use my skills to bring about something that's always been a through line in my entire life, which is more empathy and understanding and less judgment in the world. So I wanted to find a way to do that, but it took many years I almost left filmmaking behind to even just go to a whole different career. But when I guess I found really my true calling when in 2010, my husband, John, who's here with me, right next to me today, was denied desperately needed treatment for a decade-long addiction to crack in favor of a prison sentence, when what he needed was treatment and what he wanted and had asked for was treatment. The prison where he was sent did not offer any treatment for addiction, and in fact, cost taxpayers about an average about $75,000 a year to house him and then deliver him back out more traumatized and still addicted. So, you know, he came out worse off than when he went in. Want to talk a little about that?
Well, where do you want me to begin? it was a long story of how I got involved in doing crack, too long to go into, but it was a terrible situation. I had a terrible addiction to it. And so I was looking at doing several years in prison. If it wasn't for Rebecca, I would have been doing that amount of time too.
Well, here's the thing is, if for anyone who's ever, you know, had to stand by and helplessly watch as their loved one is sent to prison, it's such a devastating experience because prisons in the United States are such disease-ridden, vile, dangerous, unsupervised places where our human rights are denied on a grand scale. And so John has stories that we don't often get to tell, which are quite eye-opening because they're like stories you would hear in a war zone. And every single day that John was there was tough for me. I sometimes wonder whether it was harder for me than it was for him, but there are so many, you know, abuses happening there. Definitely not places of rehabilitation. He witnessed a young kid, maybe just 18, commit suicide right in front of him. And he called for guards for 45 minutes. No one would come to help the young man.
Yeah, it was terrible. It is a very terrible place to be. And yeah, they ended up, I called for them and there was no response. I kept calling and screaming. And finally, they did come reluctantly. They told me to back away. They went in. He was already passed out from the loss of blood. And they just kind of jokingly picked up his legs and then dragged him away. And I saw the trail down the corridor as they took him away. I never saw him again. It was a terrible situation.
I mean, he saw the guards beat people for small little things, just nearly to death or maybe to death. No one really knows what happens to these people. It's a very dangerous environment. So,
and every day is life-threatening.
Yeah,
right. Right.
Yeah. Really severe.
Yeah. You know, the thing that strikes me as I'm listening to you both is what a disconnect there is for the average person who thinks about prison and the experience of someone who's been in prison and how we desperately need to get our minds wrapped around that disconnect. And that not only are prisons terrible places for the prisoners, they are dehumanizing places for the correctional officers themselves. That no one comes out of this experience better than they went in.
No.
And I think that is a particularly important part of the story because we still talk about it as the correctional system.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Well, it is not so much.
It is not a place for rehabilitation. It is a place of punishment.
Yeah. It's totally punitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really, I've come to realize, and I'd like to get into talking about like what mass incarceration is in our country and what's caused it. But over the years that we've been doing this work, more and more, I've come to realize that if we were to step back and look at mass incarceration from a broader perspective, one could conclude that it's a reflection of the fact that we've given up on huge sections of our society, pockets of people in our society that we want to forget about. And so that is either because of their race, which is based on the statistics. Definitely there's a lot of racial bias there, which is very obvious and clear. But there's another kind of bias that also is worth definitely noting, which is that a lot of times people look at addiction as a moral failure.
Right.
Instead of as a disease. You know, 50% of people in federal prison are there because of a drug-related crime. And the vast majority of those people weren't dealing drugs. They were caught with possession because they're addicted to them. And obviously prison is not a place for, you know, rehabilitating people with drug addiction or mental health issues. 70% of people, this is an interesting statistic too, that have addiction issues to start with, substance abuse disorder, have childhood trauma. So they're suffering from trauma anyway, which is probably what has led them to the mental health crisis and the drug addiction that they're struggling with. And then we're putting them in a place that just compounds that trauma. And that brings me to one more subject, which I want to mention. And so we've invented these, in order to sort of dismiss ourselves from the moral responsibility that we have toward these people, to take care of them compassionately, we have invented a whole new slew of slurs, of derogatory names to call them. We've moved on from racial slurs because those are too politically incorrect to use. Okay. So now we're calling these people things like felon, perpetrator, and criminal. And that's our way of sort of dismissing our own responsibility toward them, minimizing their value as human beings.
Let me just say, that's not the way it is though, behind bars.
Oh.
When you're behind bars, you would not believe how people are referred to, how the sheriffs refer to individuals. I mean, they literally will say racist terms that you'd think were back in the 50s and 60s.
Right, because they have all the power. We are doing this interview in the middle of the Derek Chauvin trial. And it's been fascinating for me as I've dipped in and out, because it's honestly very, very hard to watch.
It is.
But to see how the defense is trying to use his addiction against him. And I find that so deeply offensive, because you would never say, oh, someone has cancer, let me use that against them.
Yeah, right. Let me punish them for cancer by locking them up somewhere, turning my back on them and forgetting that they exist.
Yeah. Right. So there's so many levels and layers to this that I think we as a society are going to have to start to deal with in a meaningful way if we're going to make any progress. And something that you do that I find really interesting is that you very intentionally work with other filmmakers who are themselves also formerly incarcerated. Why was it important to you that your team was built of those people?
Well, that's a great question. And there are two main reasons. One is that we don't want to make the historical mistake of telling the stories only from our perspective, because that would bias the stories. We want to bring in people to, you know, interview the defendants and their families that shares their same cultural experiences and life experiences, so that we can more accurately frame their story. But also, what I think the real advantage of going in is when we enter these defendants' houses, we show up at their little trailer, or sometimes their tent or their motel room or their sober living home or their wherever they are, we're often met across the board with skepticism and suspicion. They don't
even
open
hostility.
They don't open their doors warmly, because look what they've been through. Yeah. They do not trust the criminal justice system. They don't know, their defense attorney sent us there, and they're thinking, they don't believe for an instant we're there to listen, right? But when they find out that we have walked in their shoes and that we are there to listen to the best of our ability to help them tell their story, the whole story, the floodgates open. There is such a deep need for them to, I mean, the tears, it's hard to sometimes get the defendant and their family to stop crying to tell their story, because there's such a feeling of like relief that finally they're being listened to. And so by the time this story gets to the judge and the probation department and the prosecutor, there is no doubting its authenticity. I mean, I think that's why our stories speak to these court officials.
I think that something people often underestimate, because we don't think of it in this specific way, is the importance of feeling heard and how it is just critical, even if someone disagrees with you, even if they come to a different conclusion about what is appropriate, in this case, punishment for you, to feel that your story was heard is humanizing in a process that is fundamentally dehumanizing. So I think it's just immensely important. And I think it's important not only for the defendants, but also for the judges and the people who are the decision makers, to recognize that these are people with a whole history and all of these threads, and that they're not just the worst thing they've ever done. And these are all nonviolent offenders. I just want to reiterate that. You're not talking about people who killed anybody. And I think that it's easy, if you're working in the criminal justice system, to become quite jaded and just look at these people and just think, ugh, you know, and not really pay attention to the essence of who they are beyond that particular event.
You know, what you brought up there reminds me of so many points, but one of them that's important to mention is that one of the main causes of mass incarceration, when I say mass incarceration, I'm talking about the fact that over the past 40 years, incarceration rates have grown over 500%, not due to an increase in crime, but due to more punitive policies and sentencing. And so one of the main causes of this is that we arrest people for small, minor, nonviolent crimes and put them in prison for long periods of time. So I'm glad you made the distinction. We're not trying to achieve sentence reductions. What we're trying to do is tell the whole story so that this person isn't just a number. And I think judges want to do the right thing. Even prosecutors and probation department, these people, they are human. They're overwhelmed and overburdened, just like the public defenders are. Judges have way too many cases on their plate and a lot of pressure. And they tend to see these people as numbers after a while and aren't able to make the distinction of these important factors, such as like the real circumstance. In fact, they're not even presented with the information, to be honest, because public defenders are so overwhelmed and overburdened. The information that judges are getting is very biased. It's one-sided. It's really just facts on paper pertaining to the person's crime. It isn't around the circumstances behind the crime. Most defendants have a history of child abuse, sexual abuse, growing up in foster care, as a result of trauma in their lives. Maybe it's PTSD from war. As a result of trauma, they then suffer with substance use disorder and mental illness. This is the majority of people that commit nonviolent crimes.
And also, if those people do end up going into prison for a minor offense, then the people that they take care of, such as their parents,
yes,
could end up in homes that they would otherwise not be in.
Yes, so
and their children could end up in foster homes and foster care.
Right.
There's a lot of ramifications.
So we also are telling the judge about, we explained to the judge, hey, one of the variables to be considered here that's super important is the value that that person brings to their family and their community. Like, these are real examples. We made a film for a defendant who's the Little League coach. We made a video for a defendant who has donated for free for 20 years music lessons. He like teaches like 13 instruments to all these at-risk kids at church. Now, when he went to prison, all those kids are without his mentoring and his love. Parents get left at home without care. One defendant we're making a video for right now has a son that's living with autism, and he can't be self-sufficient. And we don't know what will happen to him. He'll probably be institutionalized when she goes to prison.
It's terrible.
I mean, and this is the thing that really struck me as I was doing my research for this interview, was thinking about the downstream consequences of the decisions that are being made, because you're not just punishing the offender, you're actually punishing a whole bunch of other people as well who have done nothing. And it doesn't mean that the offender should not have to suffer some consequences for their action, but proportionality and context seem to really matter. And in the work that you're doing, it feels like you focus on those things to tell their story.
Yes. Right, you're right. We focus on the value that they bring to their family. We focus on other things other than that one crime they committed, the mistake, and we open up the conversation to all the good things they've done, all the achievements, which is another really important point, which is that between the time that a person is found guilty and the time they're sentenced, there's oftentimes a huge gap in time there. And during that time, defendants go through this intensive spiritual and emotional journey, you know, coming to terms with their crime and learning how to verbalize it, making amends to the people they've hurt, and then kind of coming up with behaviors that can offset them ever making those specific mistakes again. And because of all this work that they're doing, these are true stories. They fully recover from drug addiction for 2 to 3 years, right? They get college degrees. One defendant we made a video for has not only received a bachelor's, but a master's while waiting to go to prison for 4 years, okay? They get their kids back. They heal wounds. They get therapy with their children to heal those wounds. So all of this transformation takes place. And for some reason, without our video, I guarantee you that this information about their incredible growth and transformation is never going to be known, made known to the judge in a way that will shift that conversation away from that first crime that they committed. And we have to ask ourselves why. I'm asking myself why. Yeah. Why?
Yeah.
Why?
I do think that one of the things we struggle with as a society is we like to go very fast. You know, everything is about, let's just move things through as quickly as possible. And that's not the nature of telling someone's story. It takes a little bit of time. It doesn't have to take a ton of time, but it takes a little bit of time, a little bit of thoughtfulness. And we're so impatient. Too long didn't read. I mean, that's who we have become as a society. And that's fine if it's an email, but that's not fine when it's someone's life.
That's not fine when someone going behind bars and leaving their whole family behind.
Yeah. I mean, because then you're also setting up a system that is going to make it much more likely that the people left behind are in a position where they're more likely to wind up with a substance abuse problem or commit a crime of their own because their structure has been completely blown up.
Yeah.
Statistics bear that out. A person who's lost a parent to prison is much more likely to end up going, being incarcerated themselves.
And so if our intention is to try and reduce incarceration and certainly reduce reincarceration, then we need to do things very differently. And what y'all are doing is, to me, such a critical part of that. One of the things that I found really interesting was that a lot of your work is really quite science-based. You look at the fact that most people are visual learners, and you use that in your work. Could you talk about that a bit?
How you started off this podcast really caught my attention, because you believe in the power of story. And I mean, that's probably what I became a filmmaker too, to begin with, all those years ago. And it turns out that by incorporating facts into a story structure, there's been a lot of scientific study, like putting people in MRI machines and studying their brainwaves and stuff, show that when a person's introduced to facts through story, that it stimulates the neural pathways, the same ones that we use when we're practicing relationship building skills. So story actually does, on a scientific level, we know, promote empathy. And then, of course, there is a lot of study around the fact that people tend to comprehend and retain content better when they hear it and see it. So I think also there's something called decision fatigue that judges go through when they really are overwhelmed. And I have some statistics, which I could spit out, but about how many, you know, cases judges take on per year, and it's ridiculous. And they have all this stuff to read. And I think that for them to be able to go and sit back and let go of reading this dry technical blueprints about a person's case and really be able to connect to that person on a human level through this video that tells such a deep and meaningful story. I mean, it really proves to shift the conversation. It's kind of groundbreaking, because we've had, like, recently a defendant who was facing 5 to 10 years for a drug-related crime. And the judge said, he, after watching our video, and it was so compelling, that he was going to make an unprecedented decision in federal court. And he chose to not send this person to prison at all. He gave him supervised release.
Wow.
The prosecution is actually up in arms about it.
Well, and sometimes the
prosecutor... I'm sure.
Yeah, the prosecutor was arguing, and the judge was like, I know I'm pulling the rug out from under your feet here. But a lot of times, too, the prosecution, after watching our video, changed their recommended sentence. The thing is just like clean drinking water is a human right, we need to understand that due process is just as much a human right as clean drinking water.
I think what we need to understand is what due process actually looks like.
Yes.
And what it looks like right now is a system that is overburdened, and you get your clients from defense attorneys. How do you establish relationships with those defense attorneys? Because these are often, I'm assuming, public defenders who are drowning in cases. So does that relationship work?
Well, we work really hard. I mean, that's a huge part of what we do, is just reaching out to defense attorneys to let them know of this new tool that exists that can tell the complete story of the defendant that they're advocating for. And they don't really have much time, which is another little brief thing I'd like to mention. Like John, for his case, he spent less than 3 minutes with his defense attorney before being sentenced to prison.
Yeah, I was
okay, so you should see my face.
Let me have John tell you that story.
Like, I was looking at doing several years, which ended up happening. But when I went in there, and after arraignment and everything else, the public defender came in and he sat down with me in this room and he said, okay. And he was very abrupt. And he said, okay, so you're guilty, right? You're going to go ahead and plead guilty. And I said, well, can I talk for a minute about it? He goes, oh, for crying out loud. He slams his document down. He walked out. About 5 minutes later, he came back in and he goes, so what do you want to say? And I said, well, he goes, are you guilty or not? I said, well, yes, I am guilty. And he said, well, then there you go. And I said, okay. And I was doing drugs. And so he goes, well, then sign. And I said, oh, okay, whatever. So I signed the paper. He got up, left. And the only time I saw him again was in court when the judge said, okay, then. He goes, the state of California versus me. And so he said, are you ready to present your case? He goes, yes, he pleads guilty. That was my defense.
So let me tell you, this is normal, because I've sat there in the courtroom and watched people, like, numbers just
one ding, after, ding, the other, ding, after the other, ding, just, like a conveyor belt.
Yeah, there's no information. There is no due process in a lot of cases here. Disadvantaged persons who cannot afford their own representation and who have to lean on a public defender. The public defenders, this guy sounds like just a bad public defender.
He wasn't very
good. But there are also really good people that we work with that we love because they're amazing and they do care about their clients, but they're overburdened and overwhelmed. And there's no way that they can provide the kind of representation that is actually afforded to every individual in our Constitution.
I mean, John, you are an educated, intelligent person who is able to advocate for himself.
Yeah.
So take that away and have it be someone who doesn't have those skills and that privilege.
Right.
And it is just a recipe for utter disaster. People being railroaded into agreements that they don't even understand the ramifications of.
That's absolutely true.
I mean, the greatest misconception about the U.S. justice system is that being assigned a public defender automatically ensures due process and full representation and an equitable outcome. It is not true. This is just not happening on any level. 4 out of 5 people cannot afford their own representation. So all of those people who are poor and disadvantaged, economically disadvantaged, have the same experience or a similar experience to what John had.
And I'm wondering, so there's the two of you, and then there's your crew, and you go into someone's home and you sit down and you talk with them, and they tell you their story. What is the thing that the people you speak to most want you to be able to convey to the judge? What is their ask once they realize that they can trust you?
Well, you know, they really don't know what to do. And it takes a while before Rebecca finally gets them to say and understand what the situation is and what they need to say, which is the truth about where they are, what they've done, and own up to what they have done.
We do
but she doesn't.
We film for 2 straight days for about 20 hours. We not only film them. You know, these aren't like small, quick things.
No.
We put so much. These are works of art, truly. What we're doing is we're fighting against a system that gives no time. And we're trying to balance that, right? So we give that person, and not only them, but their family. So we usually pick at least 4 people from their close family, their children, their grandparent,
pastor.
Their mother. And then we take people from their community who can speak on their behalf, their pastor, maybe their rabbi, their teacher from college or school, other people from their community. And so it's a combination of all these different people that, first of all, we want to show the multidimensionality of this person, right? So all the good things this person does, all the responsibility they take in their lives, and the love that they give, the importance they have to everyone, their neighbors and everyone in their community. Then we want to show the underlying reasons behind, you know, things come up about their childhood abuse and sexual trauma and things like this that come up so that the judge and the courts that watch the video can understand that there's trauma and hurt there that needs to be dealt with. And once we can address that, that person can heal and recover.
We actually put on the website several good examples of some of the sentencing videos that we've made. And people should go to it and take a look at them because they are incredible what Rebecca and Complete Picture has put together.
And one of the other things that I want to note that we show that's super important, number one, like probably across the board, is their remorse.
I was just going to ask you about that because you said something about their shame. And I was thinking, you know, shame is such a double-edged sword because it either can drive you to just hide.
Or do more drugs.
avoid. Or it can drive you to change your behavior and say, I'm never going to do that again. It can push you towards contrition or into a hole so deep that you can't see your way out. And so I'm curious, in the encounters that you've had with the people you've filmed, sort of what your experience of that spectrum of shame, contrition is with them.
Well, first of all, I love the questions you ask. They're so good.
Thank you.
Every story is unique. Every story
is
unique.
The thing is that what we've come to realize is the very act of filming them, the defendant tends to sit in a room nearby and just cry all day long because they're hearing these stories from their family and community of their value and how much they're loved and needed. And they've been so buried by their shame of what they did that they can't take away. This has made them feel powerless and helpless, and that what they're doing to their family, and to be to spend 2 days listening to things maybe no one's ever told them about how important they are and how valued they are. It's like they shed a new leaf, right? They, in a way, they're sort of glowing at the end of the whole process because it helps them start a new chapter in their lives. I think this ritual in itself is healing, of allowing their family to express why they're meaningful to them. And so that's one of the things I think about. But the road to true remorse is a complicated and long path. And I don't think that most defendants have coaching in that area.
Right.
But if they have connection to like a rabbi or a preacher or something from their church, they may have done some work here. But a lot of times they don't know the steps. There are like steps you can take to kind of climb your way through your guilt and your shame and come out of it a better person.
Again, this is where having people that have gone into the prison system come out and become filmmakers themselves, why it's such an asset to have them come in with us, because they know where they're at. They know how to help them to get past this shame and this other situation that they're in so that they can see there is light at the end of the tunnel.
It's interesting because as you were talking about that and your description of the defendant sitting in the other room and just crying, what struck me was, as you said, they are crying not just because of shame, they're crying because this is probably the first time they realize how loved they are.
Yes.
Yes.
And that is such a gift. And that is, in my thinking, part of the way out of where they were to where they would like to be, is to be able to hear how loved they are and how much good they bring to the people around them. And to just sit there for 2 days and have to do that, I'm sure it's enormously uncomfortable for them in some ways, but uncomfortable in that way of, oh, actually, I am a worthy person and I've just been seeing it wrong this whole time.
That's right.
Especially when it's their turn to get up and tell their story.
People become what they're told they are.
Yes.
And so to hear that you are, that how others see you, is that you're a light and a strength in their lives, is you know, reinforcing that they will be that. They will continue to be
that. I mean, I have to say, I am almost in tears on this side, just listening, because there's so much in people that we miss. And to be able to have that elevated in people's worst moment feels profoundly important to me. So thank you for that. And I'm curious about your experiences when you make these films. How does it impact you? Because I'm sitting here practically crying. So what's it like on your end?
I cry. I cry a lot. I cry with them. I try not to cry more than them because it might stop them from telling their story. And also, you know, one of the things that I've struggled with is, I tend to not have boundaries. Maybe, you know, there are like different ideas in our society about how many boundaries we should have, about how much we should give. You know, I was raised, like I brought 7 extra kids home from school and my mom was a single mom and she raised them all. And we had 5 anyway. And so, you know, I was kind of raised thinking you can always give more. And it's fun to give. It's so fulfilling. It makes life meaningful. And what you think you can't give, just test yourself, right? Because probably you can give a little and you'll find that when you give, you receive. And so I tend to get attached to the idea of maybe helping bring in the defendant's children so they don't go to foster care. You know, recently we offered to take in a child when and if this defendant, who will be sentenced on the April 15th, goes
between 5 and 40 years
for marijuana cultivation. Yeah. And she's got this beautiful 5-year-old girl, little girl. And
sweetheart.
Nowhere for her to go. For me, it's...
It's very likely we are going to end up having to take the child in,
well,
too.
Not having to. I love...
She's a sweet little girl.
Yeah, but sometimes I question, like, is there a limit and how much, where should the boundaries be? That's something that we talk about a lot. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine so. And I think that often we don't know what our boundaries are. We think we do. And then we find out that they're actually a little further out than we thought they were.
Yes.
So, you know, I think we often rise to meet the moment. And that is the thing about humans that is the best thing about humans is our capacity to do that. I'm just kind of blown away by this because it is so important to me to see people and to have people be fully seen. And that's why I love stories so much. And that's why what you two are doing particularly spoke to me. And because our time is coming to a close, I'd like to ask you to give the listeners three simple things that they can do if this is something that speaks to them and they want to in some way contribute to this kind of work, to this, just this way of perceiving in the world even.
This is a little metaphorical, but try to look without judgment. Try to look with curiosity, not with judgment. I learned that from a dance teacher. Whenever the dancers would be dancing, she wouldn't be going watching them. She'd go around and look at those of us who were not dancing, who were observing, and say, watch with curiosity, not with judgment. So, you know, all of us need to constantly work on that because we imprison each other by the limitations we place on one another by our judgments. But on a practical level, please donate to completepicture.org because even, you know, small donations like $10 help us stay afloat to keep doing this work. And a second thing you could do is you could join up with a group that you belong to, like your church or synagogue or your work group, your company, and sponsor a video for someone, a nonviolent criminal who's facing prison, a nonviolent individual who's facing prison. And by doing that, we'll invite someone to represent your group to go along on our film shoots and get to know the defendant and the family. And this is important because if that person goes to prison, then your group can write them letters to uplift them. They can help do food drives and clothing drives for their children. It's just another pro-social support system that can eventually, in many multiple ways that you couldn't dream of, help that individual when they get out of prison as well to not go back. They need more support. And so your group could not only be sponsoring their video, but becoming an important part of that person's lives. And lastly, if you have a skill that you think we could benefit from, please donate your time.
Yeah, well, I will put all of these on my website and they will also go in the episode notes for this conversation. And I just have to tell you, I am so very glad that I found you. I don't even remember how, but I'm just so very glad because the work you're doing is beautiful and needed and healing. And my feeling is even if someone doesn't necessarily get the judicial outcome that they're looking for, that just having done this piece puts them in such a much better position and gives them an emotional understanding of their value that will help them as they navigate prison. So I'm just enormously grateful that you're doing this work. It's beautiful work. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you so much, Omkari, for recognizing us and giving us an opportunity to tell the world about what we're working on.
Oh, we appreciate it. Absolute pleasure. Absolutely. If you're a regular listener, you know how important I believe story to be in how we move through the world. Our sense of self and relationships, both intimate and with the larger world, are impacted by the stories we hold and the way we hold them. And the stories that John and Rebecca share are so important. And it's why I end every single episode with these words: change starts with story. So keep sharing yours. Thank you so much for listening, and I will be back with another episode of Stepping into Truth very soon.